Hello everyone, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. Once again, and after a longer hiatus, we are back. My name is Stefan Sasse, I am a contributor to the Tower of the Hand, and I have my own blog for all things nerd at thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com. And with me, as always, is...
Sean T. Collins. I am the creator of Oil Leather Must Be Boiled at boiledleather.com, which may or may not be the place where you found this podcast. I also cover Game of Thrones and assorted other television programs for Rolling Stone, but I'm currently working on Game of Thrones because Game of Thrones is back, baby. And I write for BuzzFeed and Wired and various other places. And I co-wrote the official annotated version of A Game of Thrones with Elio Garcia and Ann Grohl for the Subtext iPad app. Today, longtime listeners will be excited to discover, we are returning to our recurring series on the women of Westeros, and we were at the point in the series where natural pairings didn't necessarily suggest themselves until Stefan came up with what I think is a fairly interesting rubric for the three women we'll be talking about today. Stefan?
Yeah, what we are doing basically today is to talk about three women, as you already said. It will be Marjorie, Melisandre, and Lysa Arryn, or Lysa Tully, as you choose as you prefer. And what ties them all three together is that they are female ruler persons, so they are very involved into the political process, and they all approach it from very different angles. And it seemed to us that it is a logical theme to examine these women together. And we would like to make the start with Marjorie. And you said when we started, before we started recording, that you had some specific ideas about each of these women. So I'm excited to hear what you have to say about Marjorie, especially since you are the lucky guy who got to interview Natalie Portman.
Yeah. First of all, I do want to say, and I've said this pretty much here, there, and everywhere, but you know, so far I've only spoken to two cast members from the show, Natalie Dormer and Sophie Turner, for a series of weekly interviews I'm doing for Rolling Stone that follow up on, you know, whatever happened in the previous night's episode. And they were both so sharp and so tuned in to, like, the nuances of the character, of the world, of the sort of dynamic between that character and other characters with whom they come in contact. You know, they were, you know, I've thought about this stuff a lot in the context of both the books and the show. And I think both of them enlightened me somewhat as to what's really going on with these characters. And that's exciting, and I think that's... You already see it on screen, I think, with the characters who've benefited most from the translation from prose to film. And in this case, I'm thinking Sansa in particular, Marjorie also. I know that's more controversial. Bronn. There's a certain lived-in quality that comes naturally from actors who are, after all, flesh-and-blood human beings, that helps you appreciate these characters, particularly when the writers seem to really go for the gusto in writing them. And you bring that back to the books. And that's the thing. Right. And that's the thing about Marjorie. When I first started writing about the show's version of Marjorie, virgin, no pun intended, I mentioned that, you know, with the obvious difference of her age, I wasn't really convinced that we were seeing anything that couldn't be read between the lines of the books. Now, I said that, and then I reread the books, and I do think that in retrospect, I was wrong. Because I believe it's Littlefinger, who I know for sure that he says she doesn't seem particularly interested in being a queen. And I'm pretty sure he also says she doesn't seem particularly interested in sex. Obviously, the Marjorie of the show is different in both respects. But that said, it's not really something I care about because it's an interesting character as it appears on screen. And I think either way, the same dynamic applies. I think the Marjorie in the books may use different tactics to endear herself to other power players and to the people. But I think she's much, much shrewder about it in both cases than any of her sort of immediate opponents in the Lannister family. And one thing I've been kind of delighted by in the episodes of the show that I've seen, this is not spoiling anything, is Cersei's awareness that, like, this person outclasses us. Like, we just need to raise our political game if we're going to have any hope of keeping up with this girl. And that's more or less the same fear that she has, although albeit expressed in the sort of more, what's the word I'm looking for? Hysterical bears with it all sorts of gross sexist connotations, but the sort of panic that the book Cersei has that the show's Cersei really doesn't. You know, but it's alarming to people like the Lannisters who are used to buying and threatening their way to everything. The Tyrells operate differently. They bribe, which is a little bit different than sort of exchanges of cold, hard cash. You know, they bribe with food. They bribe with just being nice. And they, you know, they win people over to their cause in that way. So it doesn't really matter to me that the show's Marjorie takes her top off and is older and has all this American psycho banter with Joffrey, because I think that the book's Marjorie, were she of age, would probably be operating in the same way. And she's younger, so she's not, but I think the goals and the ideology behind it remain the same.
Yeah, I think it is very important in the case of Marjorie that you draw the distinction between the series and the books, because she is one of these characters that really differ, and I can't put my finger on it which of them are better, but I would tend to the Marjorie of the series, because in the books we always had this problem. I think, when I remember correctly, that many discussions are over at Westeros or in the fandom at large about Marjorie always concerned the point whether or not she had any agency whatsoever, because right. In the books there is not much to it. It could be between the lines. I mean, you have to take what the Littlefinger says with a grain of salt anyway.
That's true.
So that's not a proof in one way or the other, but I would, out of my guts, more agree with Littlefinger's take than to say that the show Marjorie could be just reading between the lines. I think in the books, Marjorie is more or less a piece and not a player in the Game of Thrones, whereas she is on the show very much a player. And at least the equal to the Queen of Thorns. I think they are both allies on equal footing, whereas in the show, the Queen of Thorns, in the books, the Queen of Thorns, she pulls all the strings. And so I think as a character, Marjorie is much more interesting in the show because she simply is something of a character and not just doe-eyed, brown-haired girl that happens to look good and faintly resemble Lyanna and goes into all these plots as this piece. She is the stuff to mortar several alliances, and I think she is very aware of that in the books, but it doesn't form her character in any way. There are other Tyrells that are making the decisions. And in the show, they decided, obviously, to give her more agency, more screen time, more to do, and that makes her into a more interesting character. Book nuts will, of course, not like it, but I think that will be a very interesting point once the series is done. I guess we will make a podcast about it. So I won't go into too many details about the qualities of these interpretations and adaptations, but the Marjorie from the show is more like a character I could work with.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I'll say this in defense of the book Marjorie. I hope I'm not repeating myself, but I could see the show Marjorie simply being the book Marjorie fast-forwarded through time, you know? Because I think you're right. She's obviously in a subordinate position to the Queen of Thorns in terms of the Tyrell family power structure and her agency within it. But it's clear that the Queen of Thorns is not grooming her to be a puppet the way Cersei is grooming Tommen to be a puppet. Even though Cersei, I don't think Cersei thinks she's grooming Tommen to be a puppet, because she keeps telling Tommen he should, you know, do for self the way that Joffrey did. But I don't think she really means it in her heart of hearts. You know, Tommen is her vector for power. So, and I don't think that's the case with the Queen of Thorns and Marjorie in the books at all. The other thing I will say in favor of book Marjorie having maybe a little bit more to her than meets the eye is the suddenness and ferocity with which she turns on Cersei after her fall from grace. she, you know, she figures out exactly what Cersei was up to, and she's like, I'm not, you know, I'm dispensing with the pleasantries, bitch. You did this on purpose. I know what you're after. Fuck you. That's kind of cool for, you know, a kid to say to one of the most terrifying people in the whole story. You know, so good for her. That says to me that she's not a docile little lamb the way the non-Joffrey Lannister kids are. You know, or even frankly the way, you know, there's really at this point no bigger Sansa fan than me, but Sansa would not say something like that to Marjorie. I mean, to Cersei. Marjorie, and, you know, for good reason, because Sansa has no power base to back her up, at least not openly.
Just wanted to mention Marjorie has an army.
Right, exactly. Marjorie's got an army. Marjorie's got power players who are the equal of Cersei and you know, Kevin Lannister. So, and she knows it. And that's, I guess, the point I'm trying to make. She knows it. So there's something to book Marjorie, but show Marjorie, I think, the decisions that they made in casting and in writing and in how the character is presented, enable them to take those little seeds and really make them blossom into a full rose garden, if you will.
Yeah. I again think that we will cover this point in much more detail once the series, third season, is done. But the creators of the show, they are very good in these consequences of aging their characters. And so I think you really have a point here. What I just considered as you were talking, as you mentioned, Kevin, in the epilogue chapter of A Dance with Dragons, we have obviously Kevin and his death at the hands of Varys. But before he dies, he contemplates the actual political situation in a bit of exposition, mm-hmm. so to speak. And he also says, in this exposition, that Cersei was right and that the Tyrells are groping for much more power than he first anticipated. And speaking that the Queen of Thorns has already departed King's Landing and Mace Tyrell is besieging Storm's End. So who is the guy pushing for this more Tyrell power than before? I mean, Marjorie is obviously imprisoned at that moment, but that is not to rule her out as a driving force. But obviously, it can't be the Queen of Thorns, I guess, because she simply is... She's too detached geographically. So someone is pushing the Tyrell case in absence of the Queen of Thorns. And obviously he or she is very good at it. So there really might be more than meets the eye, or have I overlooked some?
I don't know. Who else is in town at that point? Now I'm opening the book to see if I can find it. Is it one of their bannermen?
And that might be. I mean, it is not Randall Tarly because he's in Maidenpool. So who else is there? We would have, we should have brought a list of the small council. There surely is someone who could push it, but who?
Well, I'm sure it's a very obvious thing that our first commenter will be like, oh, it was so-and-so, you dopes.
Yeah. Okay, so if you are listening to this podcast, head to the comments right away if you have the right idea. I don't think we will solve it in the course of this podcast. Perhaps we will come to it later. But that is a thought to ponder on, and it just came to me as you mentioned Kevin.
Yeah.
Because the roses in general are more than meets the eye. They are this very... friendly and cheery, and you don't really take them seriously because they're so open. I mean, the Queen of Thorns, for example, she always says that one's stupid, that one's stupid, that one's stupid. So you don't really take her for a real power player because obviously the one who plays the Game of Thrones is silent. But this is a very valid strategy they are running there, and a very interesting one because the others don't anticipate it.
Yeah.
So there really could be more to it. I have to give that a little bit more thought.
Mm-hmm. Well, shall we shift over to one of the less subtle of the female characters?
Yeah, less subtle. That hits it. I think you are thinking Bad Lady, right?
Yes, indeed. Indeed. Would you like to know my very specific thought about Melisandre?
Oh, yes. Oh.
My very specific thought about Melisandre is that I don't know that she tells us really anything at all about the role of women in Westerosi society, almost exclusively among the major female characters, because she's so sui generis because of her very direct exercise of supernatural power in the pursuit of political power. There's nothing else like it. And, you know, I think you kind of have to throw all the rules out when you're talking about somebody who rose to the position to which she rose because she can use magic to kill people in a way that's obvious to everyone. She can use magic to see the future in a way that's obvious to everyone.
She's not really a woman, but a harbinger of the Red God.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, that's I'm simplifying it somewhat because obviously there's a sexual component to her character. You know, and it's a female heterosexual sexuality. You know, she's beautiful to a degree that people find disturbing because she's so otherworldly. And we know that she looks the way she looks on purpose. She uses magic to look that way. So
is this really proven?
Well, I've had this discussion with I don't remember if it was Elio or Linda. I assume it was Elio. And he said that I think I had initially asserted that she's glamoring herself to make herself look younger. Right. And Elio was like, no, I think it's more that she is literally built up her own life force somehow. It's not just like an illusion the way Mance looking like Rattleshirt is an illusion.
Yeah.
And vice versa. And that makes sense, you know, because, well, actually, I don't know if we can read into the fact that people have had sex with Melisandre and not noticed that she's some old woman like the lady in room 237 in The Shining. I don't know that we can deduce that means that there's something different going on than a regular glamour, because John dueled with fake Rattleshirt, and it seems as though his skill level was unexpected, but in terms of his size and his sort of general physical comportment, I don't recall John ever being like, this guy doesn't, you know, Rattleshirt was thinner than this, or Rattleshirt was taller than this, or unless Rattleshirt and Mance happened to be very close in build, it seems like the glamour is such that
There was one comment from John when Rattleshirt is in his armor that he looks different than when he has the bones on, something like that. I don't remember whether it was thinner or thicker, but one of these. So he definitely sees that something about the size is off, but he attributes it to the bones, which is, I think, exactly why Melisandre insists on Mance's keeping the bones on.
Yeah, that's because, true, yeah.
So I guess, but this reinforces your point that it can't be a glamour because people wouldn't notice. I guess a 60-year-old can't simply feel other than a 20-year-old. So
yeah, Melisandre was not wearing any bones when she made those shadow babies with Stannis. So that's
exactly
not in play.
Exactly.
So yeah, you know, my point was that there are, she uses aspects of femininity to achieve her desired ends, but you know, you can look at Makoro as a counterpoint, who's not attractive to Victarion in any way, but he's still magnetic to Victarion because for many of the same reasons that Melisandre is magnetic to everyone that she's magnetic to, including Queen Selyse. Right, especially Stannis, but also including Queen Selyse, who, as far as we know, has no romantic designs on Melisandre, who just was simply captivated by her power and her confidence, and I, you know, and you know, perhaps genuine religious fervor. So Melisandre is just, to me, a tough character to look at the way you would look at almost anyone else that we've tackled in the series, from Catelyn to Margaery to Brienne to Sansa to basically anybody. She kind of is her own category.
Yeah, that's true. And as you are rolling out that thought here, it is a bit odd that even her enemies don't really use this aspect. I mean, she obviously has magic capabilities. She believes in a god fervently that is really not popular in Westeros, to say the least.
Right.
And she serves Stannis, the rebel, and has brought him to conversion and all that stuff, but they don't really go for the she's a witch, burn her at the stake or something, which you might expect from such a woman. It seems like a bit muted, like they don't want to recognize her as a power presence at all, which might be this anti-magic bias that Westeros has, courtesy of the Maesters. I'm not quite sure, because I mean, Stannis is around for a long while,
yeah,
together with Melisandre, especially at the point of a dance with dragons, and still no one on the side of his enemies really talks about Melisandre. It is not like, oh man, now he's gone, send an assassin to the wall and kill the red bitch or something. She simply doesn't really exist for them. I think his enemies don't really believe in her magic powers yet.
Yeah.
It is Stannis's bannerman and stuff, everyone who came into direct contact with her, that knows that something is off about that woman, this really asexuality about her, that is strange dynamic somehow, and that Davos feels himself drawn and disgusted from at the same time.
Yeah.
But whoever has not met her is not really impressed.
Right, I think they have known, you know, Joffrey or Euron Greyjoy or Mance Rayder before they get to know her. They're no more going to send, well, Mance Rayder, it was not an issue because he didn't really even realize Stannis was a factor until Stannis slaughtered all his men. But none of them are going to send an assassin to kill some dopey red priestess any more than they'd send an assassin to kill Patchface, you know? To them,
yeah,
this is just some affectation that shows that Stannis is an out-of-touch. You know, I mean, you can almost imagine American modern political campaign ads being cut about, like,
yep,
Stannis Baratheon keeps a red priestess in his retinue. He's out of touch with the real America. You know, like, they just think it's some stupid, you know, it's like Mitt Romney's Mormonism, essentially.
Yep.
And, you know, or even, you know, I don't even think it rises to the level of, what was his name? Is it Jeremiah Wright? Am I getting that right? You know, the preacher whose church Obama attended for years before he ran for president. Yeah, it was Jeremiah Wright. I don't even, you know, they managed to, you know, the Republicans managed to make hay out of that, frankly, because they're racist. But it didn't. I don't think Melisandre even rises to that level. I think she's just some goofy, weird thing that they think of when they think of Stannis. You know, they have no idea what's really going on there.
I think it would be blowing into their face, because we have this really deep anti-magic bias with this, you believe in Grumpkins and Snarks too, snigger, snigger. And that means if I take serious the Red Woman as an enemy, everyone will say, you're afraid of Grumpkins and Snarks, snigger, snigger, snigger. And I would be diminished in my worth and in my pride and everything. And so these biases, they really forbid any enemy of Stannis to take her seriously, which may come down as a merit for him at this specific point.
Yeah, I think, excuse me, my voice cracked. Yeah, I'm going through puberty thinking about Melisandre, apparently. I think you're absolutely right. I think that, well, I think two things. I think it's interesting that Varys, of all people, if his words can be taken at face value, is the person who senses the threat that Melisandre represents. And I also think that maybe we can learn something about the state of women in Westeros from Melisandre then. Because as you said, Melisandre, her position as a priestess of the Red God and her rumored association with magic mean that her opponents basically are forbidden from taking her seriously. It makes her invisible in a way to her opponents, not to her followers or to Stannis' followers, who all live in sort of abject awe and terror of her, but to people who don't know her and who are opposed to her and Stannis. As you say, they would look bad if they took her seriously. And she's able to use that cloak of invisibility wrapped around her by her religious affiliation and her rumored – magic powers that everyone thinks magic is bullshit, to exercise power in a way that would bring down tons and tons of attention on any other woman in the Seven Kingdoms.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, when women start raising their head, it sort of becomes like a little bit of a game of whack-a-mole. You know, people that game you play at an arcade where, you know, the little things pop up and you have to hit them with the hammer as soon as they pop up. Mm-hmm. But Melisandre is able to stay up above ground for a long time because if you take her seriously, you look like a joke.
Yeah. So just to draw yet another connection to the modern day political campaigning, I think if Melisandre would be a politician in the present day, she would disappoint all kind of feminists if she ever came to power, because I simply can't hear imagining championing any policy that brings women into power, like affirmative action or something. She would more be the Hillary Clinton or Angela Merkel of politics today. She would make her thing, but not as a woman that is in politics, but rather as a specific player in politics. Her sex doesn't really matter to her, other than the specific appearance she has to make because of her sex. So she is a woman, so she has to be good looking. It's just a way of it. She has to wear certain clothes. She can't come in boiled leather, so to speak. I don't really think that she is a woman to enjoy this kind of stuff, really. She does it, and I think she does it convincingly, because everything she does is convincingly, especially misinterpreted prophecies.
Yeah.
That's back to your initial point. She doesn't really work politics as a woman, not in the way that Cersei or Lysa or Catelyn or Daenerys even do that.
Well,
she's
also so single-minded. You know, she has only one goal, which is Stannis is Azor Ahai reborn, and we have to get him in a position where he can fight the Great Other. It's just that simple for her. I think all the other female characters, all the other characters, really, frankly, except Bloodraven, maybe, that we know, you know, have multiple concerns. Even just small, you know, Melisandre doesn't eat.
Yep.
You know, I mean, so no, of course she doesn't care about, and really gives no thought to her gender or sexuality as anything but a means to an end. She only has one end. There's nothing else going on. The one possible exception that I find really intriguing is her brief flashback to a slave auction that we get in her POV chapter. And I think obviously a lot of speculation has centered on, well, you know, is this her? And I feel safe in assuming that it's her. And if it was her, where was she a slave? When was she a slave? What kind of slave was she forced to work as? And you may have a lot of answers there as to how she came to R'hllor and why she is the way she is now.
The interesting thing is that also comes to me right now, the slave auction, if it was her, it is also a strong indication that her present-day appearance isn't exactly what she should look like, because there is no tattoo, obviously. And she should have a slave tattoo, especially if she was sold to the Red Priest.
Yes.
Or don't they tattoo women? I don't really know.
Yeah.
But there are certainly some things that don't quite add up without the assumption that she at some point underwent a procedure that formed her appearance today.
Yeah.
I mean, Thoros, he was never a slave, right?
Not as far as we know. I mean, I don't know how much we really know about Thoros' background, but these facts sort of vanish from my mind, so...
I don't think they would have allowed him to drink himself into shame if he had been a slave.
Right,
so, should be safe to assume he wasn't.
Yeah.
So, there's just so much stuff we don't know about the cultures of Essos and these other religions, which is a point you made on the talk just today, I guess.
Yeah, now we've let them behind the curtain. They know when we recorded this, because I just put up the response about that today. But yeah, I mean, Just to allude to it briefly, you know, a person asked me if I knew of any resources where you could get the level of analysis of the politics of, you know, non-Westerosi societies that we've encountered on a level that you get for the ones in Westeros. And I said, well, no, because we don't have that level of detail, even in the cases where we know a lot more about certain societies than others, Volantis, Meereen, Braavos, and the Dothraki. We still are really only seeing these places through the eyes of one major character apiece, and Martin has very deliberately kept a lot of that information sketchy, because he says this story is about Westeros, no matter how much time he spends in Essos, and of course that leads to all sorts of complaints. Well, why? What are you doing over there? And, you know, as I said, I've said it before and I'll say it again, I'm sure, the reason we're spending time over there is to show that the players change and the rules change, but the Game of Thrones is played everywhere. There's always going to be a reason for one group of people to try and kill another group of people in order to rule over a third group of people. They're always going to be sure that they're in the right, or they're always not going to care whether they're in the right or not, because they want power. And no matter where you are, somewhere up north in Westeros, the others are waiting. And to me, that's the central message of the whole book, and that's why it's worthwhile getting these glimpses at the elephants versus the tigers, or, you know, the sons of the harpy, or all these kinds of things going on. Because to them, it's just as important as, you know, the sparrows trying to exert their influence over the High Septon, or, you know, the Blackfyre Rebellion, or whatever it is. It all matters just as much to them, and it all matters just as little in the face of the actual existential threat to all life that is massing in the North. So that's my little speech.
Yeah, exactly. I think you have a pretty good grasp on this major theme that runs through all the books. It's the same with Septon Maribald in A Feast for Crows. I think you were the first one, at least the first guy I read that pointed this out specifically, that it is an anti-war story and stuff like that. And I think you got it right here, too. So.
Well, thank you very much, Stefan. I appreciate that.
Yeah, please. Some real man laugh here.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. I guess our third character, and she is a character, is Lysa Arryn, who we're saving, you know, let's be frank, we're kind of saving the least for last, because she has played the smallest, or at least let's put it this way, she's played the most specific role in the books of the female characters we've tackled in this series so far, because she's basically there to accomplish, you know, a pair of plot points, you know, the first with Tyrion and Catelyn, and the second with Littlefinger and Sansa. And my take on her is sort of similarly specific, which is that she's sort of a cautionary tale about the importance of breeding, frankly, to this society, and the human cost of that, the human cost of that mania to perpetuate your house and your line, and the degree to which a woman's body is not her own. Lysa wanted to have children. That seems pretty clear. Just not necessarily with Jon Arryn. Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure there would have come a certain point where she, if she had had her way, would have said, you know, enough's enough. My mind and my body can't take much more of this. But that was not an option for her. And that was not an option for her, you know, sort of at the behest of the good guys, or at least the people who raised the people we're supposed to, or who might traditionally be viewed as the good guys in a world like this. So it's, you know, she's a tragic character, even though she's kind of funny and kind of ridiculous and kind of infuriating and kind of terrifying and just sort of presented as a little bit of a joke. It's black humor. You know, I don't want anyone to ever think that we're meant to laugh at Lysa and that's it, and then there's nothing else going on there. I think there's a lot more going on there, in fact.
Yeah. I think it is hard to see Lysa Erin as I don't know how to put it. You said the least for last, and she is obviously not a character you can love in any way. She doesn't have any trait that we could admire. She is described as being dull even when she was a teenager, and the years certainly haven't improved her.
Mm-hmm.
But she is also this victim of a very sexist world, a very macho chauvinist world.
Yes.
And
yes.
So you have to have some pity for her. But she's clearly so much over the edge that it is hard to get a nuanced opinion here, I find. I mean, give me one guy, or one gal for that matter, who didn't cheer when Littlefinger put her out the moon door.
Right.
Seriously.
Right.
If this is one moment to look forward into the series.
Yeah.
Because this moon door in the floor just will make this scene so much better. And
yeah.
Well,
I mean, granted, at the time she was trying to murder a character who we do like, who hadn't done anything wrong at all, so... You know, that's
yeah,
so the deck
yeah,
was sort of
sure.
stacked against her, you know.
But seriously, you didn't like Lysa Erin.
No, of course. Of course.
That just reinforced an opinion you already had.
Yeah.
And so it's a bit difficult for me to say she is a vehicle to carry out this specific point that your body doesn't belong to you and stuff. I mean, it's all true. And we see it in several other characters as well.
Mm-hmm.
Just look at the marriage between Sansa and Tyrion. It is a prime example of it. Or Asha to this guy on the Iron Islands. I forgot his name in her absence. It all plays in this part that the women don't have agency over their own body. So I'm not quite comfortable in accepting Lysa as written with this in mind, so now you get a very drastic version of this or something like that. She clearly is nuts, and she had roots for this. The origins of this, so to say, mental illness were clearly laid out before. I mean, she slept with Littlefinger when he was in his delirium and clearly thought she was Catelyn, and that didn't stop her, and that should tell you that something was wrong with this girl.
Yeah.
So,
well, I mean, I think this is an important point to make. I'm recalling the political writer Roy Adroso. He does a column for the Village Voice where he just basically makes fun of right wing bloggers. And a while back, I guess he talked to Jimmy Breslin, who's sort of a legendary New York reporter, and. In talking about the poor, Breslin said, I found the quote, "Let's not glorify them. They're a pain in the ass." And, you know, he was being flip, but his point was there's nothing ennobling about suffering under a class system, a gender system, a race system, in which you are the bottom of the totem pole. It may make you more empathetic, you know, but it also may make you a crazy asshole. And somewhat literally, in this case, it drove her insane. I mean, Lysa Erin was mentally ill. And, you know, and that does happen with that kind of traumatic pregnancy and miscarriage history, you know, in a very real way with postpartum depression and things like that. And... So, you know, obviously you're kind of meant to cheer when she gets tossed out the window, or at least gasp in a semi-appreciative way. I feel bad about saying stuff like that. You know, I totally cheered when John cut the head off of the fucking asshole. What was that dipshit's name?
Janus Lynn.
Yes, Janos Slint. Fuck that guy. And I, you know, of course, in real life, you know, I'm just mortified by the idea of capital punishment. But you know, there's a degree to which you go along with all of this stuff in a book like this because it's the world that they live in, and you know, no one at all will be hurt in the real world because it's fun to watch John cut the head off Janos Slint. There and now, that's not necessarily true of Lysa Erin because there's obviously a segment of any audience. Who's just like, yeah, that bitch got what's coming to them, no matter who the bitch supposedly in question is. And that's gross and unfortunate.
Yeah, that's not what I wanted to say.
Obviously. No, of course, no. I don't think so, and I hope it's clear that I'm not saying that either. I'm saying it in very specific terms about this person who made the lives of characters we care about very miserable and was trying to murder Sansa Stark. So you don't feel that and murdered Jon Arryn and helped set the whole thing in motion, and you know, so it's it's complicated. But that's kind of the point. It's complicated. You don't necessarily turn into a very sympathetic figure like Arya or Sansa or Brienne when you are on the receiving end of a bad hand dealt to you by your gender. You can also turn into Cersei. You can also turn into Lysa. And I think we do, to the extent that we talk about them in this series, certainly, we try very hard to be empathetic and to understand that these women are the product of their society and to see things through their eyes. And you can do that, but still ultimately you will come to the conclusion with some of these characters that they are assholes. And that they are, you know, in the ways that matter, bad people. And that's a grim fact of these systems that punish people for their genitals or their, you know, the family to which they were born and all these kinds of things that are under no control of the people in question. You don't necessarily come out of it as a saint. You can come out of it, you know, as a monster, a low-level monster like Lysa, or a slightly more accomplished monster like Cersei. So, you know, it's tricky.
You know, that's exactly it. I mean, Lysa, she clearly is a victim of the system, but she is also the opposite. She is a perpetrator, basically. She does bad things, and she does it knowingly. She knows exactly that she is abusing her power. It is not that she tries to do good and sparks evil things like Daenerys does, for example. Lysa simply does what she does because she can, because she enjoys that little power that the society grants her, and she lives it out to a hedonistic extent. She tries to get the most out of it, and she doesn't care at all about what happens to anyone else. And like with Melisandre before, it is not Lysa trying to make it easier for other women in comparable situations, because there are hundreds and thousands of them. She could perhaps try to help them as a female ruler, but she doesn't. It doesn't concern her in any way. She is a victim, and so she's aware of that, and so she's trying to get the best of it. And she doesn't care if anyone else goes down because they are all victims. She has suffered through it, so others can suffer through it. I think that's something she also says to Sansa more or less directly. So she doesn't feel for Sansa as being a victim because she was a victim too, so why not other people? And now she isn't a victim anymore, and she will enjoy it instead of help someone. And that part makes her into a bad person, because it doesn't matter how much you are a victim or have been one. When you don't make something of it, when this stops, you are simply an asshole.
Yeah.
I don't know how many of our listeners have seen Django Unchained, for example, but the character the Django plays, this black slaver, there were guys like this, and they were fucking assholes. They were slaves before, they were victims of the system, but now they are abusing it in the same way as before. It doesn't make them better that they were victims before. So that's
It's a phenomenon called internalized depression. You know, and it's you see it in ways macro and micro all over the place. This, you know, I mean, yeah, that's what it comes down to. There's nothing inherently ennobling about suffering.
Yeah, it's really, and it is also a very common and quite frankly disturbing phenomenon that people, when they come out of their victim relationship, so to speak, that they are instantly setting up as the oppressors. I think it is more the exception that people then try to help and do everything in their power to get other people out of the situation, but that they are mostly reproducing the same oppression systems that they suffer through.
Yeah.
And this is, I guess, and I wouldn't take her so much for an example as of how women are victimized in this society, but in how little can change even when women finally come into power like Lysa does. Yeah. It's a very bleak and pessimistic approach, granted. But I guess what we see of her justifies.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I also think that someone, any woman ruler is at a disadvantage, because I think the moment you move towards making things better for, I don't even know that this is really a relevant framework of conversation for this society, because I think it's so far away from this even being a concern to anyone except perhaps Daenerys. But, you know, you see it in the real world, where if you come from a group that isn't a white man, if you do anything for the group from which you come, that's seen as like not valid. It's seen as cheating. It's seen as some kind of deviation from the norm being whiteness and maleness and straightness. So, you know, I can't imagine a woman ruler getting away with trying to improve the lot of women. You almost like to a fault, they'd have to move away from that. You know,
yeah.
Just because you don't want to be seen as the, oh, this is all she cares, you know, it's just a woman's concern, whatever. You know, you have to be, you know, there's a saying about black people in America, you have to be twice as good. And, you know, I think that's surely true of women in Westeros. Lysa is not twice as good as anything. She's just, nope. You know, she's just restrained. And I think we've probably made the point that the best place to live, in one of our first podcasts, we were like, in which kingdom or under which lord would you want to live as one of the small folk during A Song of Ice and Fire? And it's the Vale, because she's not fighting with anyone, you know?
Yeah.
Not for, you know, she's doing it for ignoble reasons, but I would love living in the Vale. I think things are about to change pretty dramatically for the Vale, but up until now, hey, sign me up.
At least for the peace part, I guess the lords there are a pain in the ass.
Yes.
But for questions of peace and prosperity, basically, yeah, pretty much.
Yep. So yeah, I mean, I feel for Lysa. I do. She's not a wonderful person by any stretch of the imagination, but she had a hard road, and it broke her, and it happens.
Yep. Definitely. And I think I don't really have something of value to add about the discussion anymore regarding her.
Well, out the moon door this episode goes then.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
that's been quite a bummer.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sorry to end on this down note. But thank you, everyone, for listening. It's always – and Stefan, thank you. I know it took us some time to get back together. But
yeah, thank you.
I'm reunited and it feels so good. And I hope we can do it again soon. So thank you, everybody, for listening. And, you know, be sure to tune in. Stefan and I are both writing a whole lot about the series, the book series and the television series in a whole lot of places. So be sure to visit boiledleather.com and the nerdstreamera.blogspot.com for all of our assorted thoughts about this stuff, even when we're not talking to each other about them. And thanks again, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.